What I've noticed is we have a lot more time than I thought we would have. A lot of time to spend now with the family, with the kids, focus on the kids and focus on each other. So the first few days were a little tough. It wasn't so tough to give up Facebook and internet and TV, but it was what I was replacing that time with was tough. I didn't jump right in like I thought I would into the Bible.
For me, the exchange has been really good. The first couple of days was hard. I realized that I'm on my phone because of boredom. Even though Facebook wasn't there, I was checking email or I was wanting to text somebody just to get a response back. It was kind of the need of just needing to feel important, and my phone made me feel important. It made me realize that I have an addiction to something that I never thought I had an addiction to.
So one of the questions in the journal is what is God saying to you? And to me, I feel, especially after a few days now, He's saying, listen to your children. Pay attention to what they're saying and doing. I've found now without those other distractions, I can watch them and listen to them and just interact with them. And they love it.
Isn't that good? To see Ryan and Keisha exchange social media and actually find out that there's a whole lot more that God wants to tell them and do in their lives. And I hope you've taken the exchange challenge. If you haven't, it's not too late. It's very simple. Paul shared with us earlier. It's kind of taking the things that may be okay or may not be okay, setting them aside and embracing something different, exchanging it for something different. We're 14 days into it, but you can start this at any time. So I would encourage you to do that. Personally, one of the things that I committed to that I've been doing the last 14 days is exchanging all of my communication with the outside world for complete focus on God when I get up in the morning. That means that until I have my quiet time, until after that's done, so from the time I get up till I have time in the Word, I'm going to listen to God rather than check my email, my voicemail, my social media page, what's going on in the news, the weather, my calendar. Because what I found is that if I get up and kind of take a look, kind of scan the world and my world, then my mind immediately becomes consumed with that, and I go into my time with Jesus, and I've got all these other things in my mind. And so God's been speaking to me really clearly during those first 30, 40, 50 minutes in the morning when I get up and I'm not already into my day until I talk to Him. So hopefully you're diving into this and you're gaining benefit and you're sharing what you're experiencing with other people. It'll change your life. Now, last week we started through the book of 2 Corinthians and we're taking a look at the exchanges that Paul is sharing with us. And last week we looked at how we exchange despair for comfort. This week we're going to start in 2 Corinthians chapter 3. So if you got a Bible, turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 3. If not, you can connect online, BibleGateway.com, or there's some all the way around the room. You can pick up a Bible. We're going to be going through one and a half chapters this morning, and we're going to see that Paul challenges us in this book that we should exchange our competence for His competence. Anybody here ever feel incompetent? Ever been in a situation where, like, you just didn't have what it takes, and you knew it, and you knew that shortly, sooner or later, everybody else was going to know it as well? That feeling started for me at a very early age. You see, when I was a kid, I had mild dyslexia, and I had trouble reading. Trouble was an understatement. To make matters worse, during my first grade year, we moved, and I entered a new school, and I got put with the teacher from hell. Literally. This is the teacher that actually tied children in their seats to keep them from getting up and wiggling around and taped their mouth shut. Now, I know you guys are thinking, but tell me there hasn't been a kid at some point in time that you met that you thought, somebody needs to tie that kid up and tape his mouth shut. Right? You know, you've all thought that. Well, this lady did it. So I spent my whole first grade year with my eyes about this big around watching what was going on in my new school, and I really had a difficult time concentrating on anything else. So I go into the second grade and I can't read, and I'm sitting in reading group. You guys remember reading group when everybody's sitting around the circle and each person is taking turns reading and it's coming to you? Well, it was coming to me. And so you may remember these pages if you were born in the early 1900s. Remember the Dick and Jane books? Okay, Dick, Jane, Spot, Sally, the little sister. And so I'm counting the number of people in the circle and where it's at, and I'm counting the pages in the book to find out what page I'm going to have to read, and then I'm looking at the picture to see if I can figure out what this little page is going to be about so I can try to figure out what the words are. And then it comes to me, and all of a sudden everything on the page just starts doing this. And I would just sit there in a cold sweat. And I vowed, like, I'm not going to ever feel this feeling again. I'm going to always be competent in whatever situation I find myself in. So I took off from there. I finished elementary school, middle school, high school, went on, did college, went into graduate school. And I'm sitting in my first Hebrew class. And guess what the professor's making us do? Read Hebrew out loud. And so I'm going to show you literally an assignment page from one of my Hebrew books. So I would be sitting in the circle looking at this. You don't recognize those letters, do you? Neither did I. So sitting in the circle, and guess what I'm doing? I'm counting. This guy's got the first line. This guy's got the second line. This girl's got the third line. This one. So I'm looking down the page at which one I'm going to be doing, and I'm trying to go over it to try to get it in my mind, to try to remember what I studied, and the letters are starting to do this again, and I'm sweating. And to make matters worse, my professor had this way about him. It was so gentle. If somebody was struggling to get through their reading, he would put his elbow on his lectern, put his hand on his chin, his head on his chin on his fist like this, and he would look at us and he would go, "We can wait. We can wait." And so literally we waited until a person struggled through it. And you know what? I vowed, I'm never going to be in this situation again. Idiot that I am, I actually majored in Hebrew after that. So I'd learn the language so I wouldn't have that situation. Wrestle with what good all that did me. And all that to say that this feeling of incompetence, it's something universal that we feel. And, you know, it's important to understand there's nothing wrong with actually being competent. Having skills and abilities, there's nothing wrong with that. Having knowledge, experience, know-how, to be able to do something well, that's laudable. There's nothing wrong with that. But when it comes to competence, there's also a dark side. And that dark side is this feeling of, can I measure up? Will I be able to prove myself? Will I be able to prove myself to God and others? Will I be accepted? Will I be made to look the fool? In the middle of all that, Paul is writing a letter to the Corinthian church, and he's writing this letter to a group of people who are questioning his competence. Now, of all the people that are competent, Paul is the guy. I mean, think about it. Paul, raised in the Jewish faith, Paul, a rabbi who studied under one of the most prestigious Jewish rabbis, he would have memorized the whole Old Testament during his formative study. Paul is not only that, but he's also a cosmopolitan individual. He's a Roman citizen, which was very hard for someone with a Jewish family line to become a Roman citizen. In addition to that, Paul kept the law. In fact, he said when it came to doing the righteous deeds of the law, I was flawless. But he wasn't just an egghead intellectual, sit around and think about it. He was actually a passionate, fanatical, committed person that was out doing action with all that. If there was anybody that was competent, it was Paul. Not only that, but Jesus Christ made a personal appearance to him and called him into ministry. So how is it that these people that he led to Christ are now questioning whether he's the real deal or not? Now, as we look at his response to that, we have three simple questions to ask ourselves. And so in this message, we're going to look at Paul, and then we're going to look at us and see how that relates. Here's the first question. Very simple. What's on your resume? What's on your resume? When you think about who you are and you describe yourself, what's important on your resume? What do you have on your resume? Look at what Paul says. Starting in chapter 3, verse 1, he says, are we beginning to commend ourselves again? In other words, are we having to prove ourselves to you again? Or do we need, like some people, letters of recommendation to you or from you? The false teachers were coming with their resumes. They were coming with their reference letters. And they were bringing those, and the people were looking at the impressive letters that they were receiving about these people, their scholarship, their study. They were looking at their oratorical skills, how great they were at moving a crowd. Can I get people to respond to me? Can I logic through the argument? Can I get people to stand up and just clap? Because this is so powerful of a message. These people were coming with that, and Paul is saying, like, do I need a resume? Do I need to come and prove that I have something to offer you? Is this what it's about? And watch what he says. This is amazing. He says in verse 2, you yourselves are letters written on our hearts, known and read by everybody. You show that you are a letter from Christ, the result of our ministry, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of human hearts. You see what Paul is saying? Paul is saying it's not about our abilities. That's not what we came to do. We came and we presented Christ to you. And you received the gospel and you responded and something supernatural took place. The letter of our recommendation, the letter that our ministry is valid, is because it changed your heart. The Holy Spirit wrote the law on your heart. The Holy Spirit formed the new covenant in you, and you guys went from darkness to light. You went from pagan to Christ followers. What more do we need? You see, what Paul is saying is this. Paul is saying that the measure of his success in ministry is based on the supernatural fruit that's being produced, not on his human abilities. He goes on in verse 4 and says, such confidence as this is ours through Christ before God. Now, look at that verse carefully. He says, our confidence is before God. In other words, we're not doing what we do to please you or to prove ourselves to you as people. We're working for an audience of one. That's God himself. And we have confidence that we're doing the right thing before him because we are in Christ and we're doing the ministry that Christ has called us to do. And then he says this. He says, not that we are competent in ourselves to claim anything for ourselves, but our competence comes from God. He has made us competent as ministers of a new covenant. Not the letter, but the Spirit. For the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. What Paul is saying is, listen, folks, our proof of our worth and value is that Jesus Christ is doing something through us. He's doing something through us. It's not about us. So let me ask you the question again. What is on your resume? What's on your resume? Are you listing out all your accomplishments? All your achievements? Do you walk into a social setting with some level that you're going to be okay in that social setting because look at who you are? Look at how you look? Look at what you've done? Is the orientation of your life around what you can pull off? In other words, your competence. Let's face it, we are a resume building society, are we not? Like, I got two kids that are currently writing their resume. They're applying for jobs, and that's a good thing, right? It's a really good thing for me. And my financial status is really helpful for that. As they're are applying for jobs, they're trying to figure out how they can take the experience on their resume and write it up in such a way that it sounds like they would be good at the job they're applying for. And I keep thinking, come on, they're just graduating from college. What could they possibly know about how to do that job, right? In other words, any employer that hires them not knowing that they're going to be trained and worked with is kind of silly, but man, we're going to work these resumes because we want to put our best foot forward. We want everybody to see it, whether it's real or not. I remember when I got invited to join the National Honor Society. And I'm thinking to myself, like, that means I'm going to have to go up on Saturday and wash cars and stuff like that, when I could be working or playing or something like that. And my parents are like, no, that will look good. When you're trying to get into college, that will look good. Like, I'm not National Honor Society material, especially if I have to go wash cars on Saturday. Like, that's not me, but boy, I got to do it. It got to look good. We're all about making ourselves appear to be competent. And when we do that, frequently we take on the need for us to prove ourselves rather than exchanging our resume for something that looks like Jesus. Christ in me, the hope of glory. That's all that really matters. So why is it that we put so much focus on our resume? I think that brings us to the second question. And the second question relates to how we actually approach life in general. So what is your general approach to life? Paul tells us in these next verses that his ministry is based on supernatural transformation, not on human effort. Look at what he says. In verse 7, he says, "Now if the ministry that brought death," speaking of the old covenant, "which was engraved in letters on stone, came with glory so that the Israelites could not look steadily at the face of Moses because of its glory, fading though it was, will not the ministry of the Spirit be even more glorious? If the ministry that condemns men is glorious, how much more glorious is the ministry that brings righteousness? For what was glorious has no glory now in comparison with the surpassing glory. And if what was fading away came with glory, how much greater is the glory of that which lasts?" What Paul is doing here is he's contrasting the old covenant with the new covenant. The old covenant that God gave through Moses when he wrote the Torah, the Ten Commandments, the list of rules and regulations for the nation of Israel, compared to the new covenant, which is written on our hearts in Jesus Christ. Now, let's look at the comparison he makes. He gives three qualifications or three comparisons of the old covenant. He says the old covenant, first of all, produced death. Secondly, it was based on condemnation. And the glory in the old covenant was a glory that was fading away. So let me explain that. The old covenant was the letters written on stone. Remember how long the nation of Israel was able to keep the old covenant? Moses is up on the mountain in face to face with God. God takes his finger. He writes the Ten Commandments on the stone. Moses starts down the mountain. As he gets down the mountain, he looks down and he sees what they're doing down there. What are they doing? They're breaking the first commandment. Thou shalt have no other God before me. Before Moses could actually deliver the package, and the nation of Israel was already in sin. So the covenant became a covenant of death because nobody can keep all of the righteousness of God perfectly. The law then becomes that which condemns us, points out our flaws. And even though God gave the law so it came with glory, the glory is fading away. The glory is fading away. But many of us still live as if we're under the old covenant. We still keep thinking that if I can just do enough good things, if I can just prove myself to God, if I can just stay on top of life and be a good person, that somehow I'm going to be competent enough to be able to please God. Max Lucado wrote about one of his tough moments. Max has got a heavy foot, and so his insurance carrier canceled him after he had too many tickets and had a fender bender. Now, some of you guys may not know Max. Max is a great guy, a good friend, pastors of a church in San Antonio, is an author, and he's pretty honest about this. So he goes home and reads this letter from this insurance company canceling his insurance for his bad driving. And while he's thinking about it, he starts thinking, I wonder how many people are waiting to get this letter from God. And so he takes the form of the insurance company letter and writes it from God, actually from Pearly Gates Underwriting Division. And here's what he says. Dear Miss Smith, I'm writing in response to this morning's request for forgiveness. I'm sorry to inform you that you have reached your quota of sins. Our records show that since employing our services, you have erred 7 times in the area of greed. And your prayer life is substandard when compared to others of like age and circumstance. Further review reveals that your understanding of doctrine is in the lower 20th percentile, and you have excessive tendencies to gossip. Because of your sin, you are a high-risk candidate for heaven. You understand that grace has its limits. Jesus sends his regrets and kindest regards in hopes that you will find some other form of coverage. I can tell that some of you have gotten a similar letter like that from your insurance carrier at some point along the way. That's what happens when we think that we can keep the law, or we can do it ourselves, or we can make it on our own. That approach to life is an old covenant approach to life. In contrast to that, look at the characteristics of the new covenant. He says the new covenant is from the Spirit, and the Spirit actually gives life, not death. He goes on to say that the new covenant doesn't provide condemnation. It actually is that which provides righteousness. And the new covenant is not something that's fading away. Actually, the glory of the new covenant is increasing. It's increasing in us until we stand in the presence of Jesus and we're like him. In other words, Jesus Christ, when he came into the world, fulfilled all the righteousness of the law. He never broke one commandment, never violated any of the law. He fulfilled it perfectly. And that's what qualified him as the Son of God to actually take on the punishment for the rest of us who've broken the law. And so what Jesus does is he takes the death on the cross. He takes the condemnation on the cross. His physical ministry was a glory that faded into death on the cross. And yet Jesus turns around, and in his resurrection, he gives life in the Spirit. Jesus gives his righteousness in exchange for our failure. And he writes it on our heart so that we grow in ever-increasing glory until we stand in the presence of God and see him, and we're transformed into his total likeness. That is a supernatural work. So do you approach life from the natural? It's all about what I can do? Or do you approach life from the supernatural? It's what Christ is doing in and through me. So watch what he says in verse 12. He says, therefore, since we have such a hope, we are very bold. We are not like Moses. Now, just let's stop for just a second. This is amazing. Like the Jews would look back to Moses in the same way that Americans look back to Abraham Lincoln. Like the guy that laid the groundwork for the values and morals that we seem to embrace today. Well, Moses was the one who spoke face to face with God and wrote down the law. So why is Moses not very bold? Why is he taking a veil and putting it over his face to hide the fact that the glory of God is no longer shining, it's dissipating? And Paul says in response to that, because we have this ministry, we are very bold. In other words, when you step out of the flesh, kind of doing it in my own strength, and you step into Jesus Christ, all of a sudden the inconfidence, or the lack of confidence because of our incompetence, changes to a confidence because we're working with him. He's working through us. It's a radical transformation. It's a radical exchange. In verse 17, he says, now, The Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. And we who with unveiled faces all reflect the Lord's glory are being transformed into His likeness with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord who is the Spirit. So here's our approach to life. Because the Spirit is in us, and where the Spirit is, there's freedom. Not only can we experience this, but we can share this with other people. Are you trapped in a cycle of needing to control? The Spirit of God can free you from that. Are you trapped in the cycle of addiction that you can't break with your flesh? The Spirit of God can free you from that. Are you trapped in a cycle of having to try to prove yourself through your success or try to feed your ego? Are you trapped in a cycle of sin that's dragging you down? The Spirit of God can free you from that, because when you look face to face into Jesus Christ, you become transformed. So what's your approach to life? Are you going back to, I've got to do this? Or are you coming to Him saying, like, you're going to do this through me? So the question is, what does that look like? I mean, for 21st century people, how do we do this? Well, let's take a look from Paul. Let's see what Paul says. So the third question, what does that look like, is actually, how do you measure success? Or what is the measurement of success for you? What is the measurement of success for you? For Paul, Paul says his life reflects both human weakness, and his weakness is success, and supernatural power. Watch what he says in verse 4, chapter 4, verse 1. He says, therefore, since through God's mercy we have this ministry, we do not lose heart. We do not lose heart. Whether things are going good or whether things are going bad. Whether things are going good, we're seeing people come to Christ, the ministry's going well, or whether we're dealing with people like the Corinthians and things are going bad, either one of those two things, we don't lose confidence, we don't give up, and in the next couple of verses he says we don't cheat. Like, we don't cheat to try to make something happen. Because we know that life is about God, and success is connecting with His plan. In fact, I want you to see some phenomenal verses, give you some insight here. Verse 3, and even if our gospel is veiled, that is, if people are not responding, that was Paul's heart, to see every man, woman, and child come to faith. He says, even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. The God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers so that they cannot see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. In other words, Satan is at work. He's the deceiver, the God of this age. He's working to keep people in the dark. And so if people aren't coming to faith, we know it's because Satan is working in their life. He goes on to say, for we do not preach ourselves, but Christ Jesus is Lord, and ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, let light shine out of darkness, made His light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. While Satan is over here trying to blind people's eyes so they can't see the truth, we know that God, the one who said, let there be light, and the universe came into existence, He's also shining His light into people's lives. He's bringing people to faith. So Paul says, it's not about my ability here. There's something that's taking place on the heavenly realm that's bigger than me, and my job is to be faithful to Jesus. When you start thinking that way, I can't control the economy. I can't control whether we're going to have a downturn and I get laid off, or whether everything's going to go up and I'm going to make a lot of money. That's out of my control. My job is to be faithful to God in this work environment, to do what God's called me to do. That's my success. To do good work, to use the gifts that God has given me, to speak love and life into the people I work with and care for, to bring Jesus to the table. That's success. That's success. I don't know whether my kids will be straight A students or whether they'll follow a path that I would never choose for them. I can't ultimately control all that, but they can see Jesus in me every single day. I can control that. I can do that. I can bring that to the table. You see the difference? Paul's saying, like, there's a lot of the stuff that's happening at a level that I can't control. But what about my job? What about my job? I can't make someone become a believer. I can't do that. But God's the one who's doing that and doing it all the time. So watch what he does in verse 7. He says, but we have this treasure in jars of clay. Now, what's the treasure? The treasure in verse 6 is the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. Now, let me unpack that for you. The light of the knowledge of the glory of God. Most of the time when we think about God's glory, we think about the manifestation of his glory, the manifestation of, you know, the bright light and the lightning and the thunder and the loud noise and the angelic beings surrounding the throne saying, holy, holy, holy. We think of the manifestation of God's glory, but underneath the manifestation of God's glory is actually the person of God himself. That's the show for him, who he is. The word glory, the Hebrew word, actually means heavy, weighty, gravity, gravitas, the most important thing. When you start thinking that he's talking about the God who said, let there be light, and in that 1 second spoke, the Big Bang happened in the universe, and all matter and all energy came into places. God guided it to where we are today. That God could do that with one word. That's the God we're talking about. And what Paul is saying is, we know him and everything about him and his plan for the world. We know all that. The light of his glory. When we look into the face of Jesus, we see the glory of God. And because of that, we have this glory in us, wrapped up by clay pots, jars of clay. He's talking about our humanity. Our flesh, our bodies, our minds, our will. Inside of this is the glory of God. It's the glory of God. Not a resident glory that we came up with. Not because we were born with it. It's a supernatural thing that God has done. So here's the crazy thing. At Christmas time, you wrap the package. And inside the package is the glory of the gift, right? It's the gift you're giving. And the kids rip the wrapping paper off and they open up the box and they reach in there and say, oh, this is what I've always wanted, and they play with their toy, right? And what happens to the box? The box gets thrown away. Except on those crazy, crazy Christmases when the kids are more interested in playing with the box than they are with the toy. And you sit back and scratch your head and go, they're missing it. They're missing it. And God looks you in the face and says, you are missing it. You're missing it. You think that the glory in your life is your ability, your achievements, your charm, your physical form. You actually think that life is about what happens in the here and now with the flesh, what I can pull off, what I can do, where I'm going today, what cool thing am I going to see, who am I going to talk to, who's going to perceive me, what am I going to achieve? All of those things, that's what we think life is all about. We're playing with the packaging. We're playing with the packaging. We have in these jars of clay the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. And we think, watching the Olympics or the Super Bowl or my kids kick a soccer ball around is what life is all about. What are we missing? We're missing the whole gospel. We're missing the whole gospel. Look at what Paul says. Verse 7. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is coming from God, not from us. We are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not abandoned. Struck down, but not destroyed. We always carry around in our bodies the death of Jesus so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. For we who are alive are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake so that his life may be revealed in our mortal body. So then, death is at work in us, but life is at work in you. Here's what Paul is saying. If you were to just follow us around, you would say, man, Paul, your life sure stinks. When was the last time you had a vacation? When was the last time you upgraded your technology? When was the last time you made a deposit in your 401k? When was the last time your boss took you out to a great dinner to say, look at all the good work you're doing? When was the last time you took a cool vacation to a tropical place? Your life is tough, man. You're out there not really paying attention to how you do. You're out there paying attention to what God is doing. And so, like every day, paying attention to this is not a priority to Paul. It's paying attention to him and what he's doing through me to other people. So let's wrap up with two thoughts. I want to get very practical here. My first one is a question. What is your message, your anthem, your song, your bio, your resume? What is it? What is it? Oh, you've got one. You've got one. It's that part of you that says, I could post this picture, but this picture makes me look old and fat, so I'm going to post this picture because it makes me look sexy. And I want to make sure that everybody sees that because I want to manage my image. I want to manage my image. It's when you walk into a group of people and people are talking and you're not listening to the intent or the heart behind what they're saying. You're trying to think of what is that witty thing that you want people to hear from your lips because you want people to think you're really witty. Or maybe it's the advice you're getting ready to deliver because you want people to think you're wise. Or maybe it's that piece of trivia that you're getting ready to say. You're thinking of what's the best thing to say because you want to make sure people think you're intelligent because you want to look a certain way to people. Watch what Paul says in chapter 4, verse 5. He says, "For we do not preach ourselves." Every single day, every one of us is constantly preaching ourselves, talking about ourselves and what we want and what we like and what we think and what we believe, what we're going to do, what we have done. Paul says, we don't preach ourselves. Our life message is not about us. Here's the mind blower. His exchange is this, but we preach Christ as Lord. In other words, when people hear Paul's life message, they find out that Jesus Christ is not only extremely important to him, he's everything to him, and they are actually seeing him shape his life around the freedom and liberation and beauty that the gospel brings. And then watch this, it's even harder. He goes on to say, and ourselves as servants for Jesus' sake. When Paul walks into a room, he says, Jesus and I are here. How can we help? How can we help? We're here to serve. How can we help? Think how much different your life would be if in every situation, whether it's work, whether it's play, in the neighborhood, with your family, you approached everything with, hey, Jesus and I are here together. How can we help you? What can we do for you? How can we, what if that was your life message? How would that change the supernatural dynamic of the fruit that you would see exploding through your life? One more. My life message? What is my life mission? What is my life mission? You say, well, that's a big question, big topic here. So let me boil it down. Life mission. If you could imagine having your best day, unlimited money, unlimited time, nobody to call you down or bug you, what would it look like? Margaritas on the beach? Final Four of March Madness? What would it look like? What would your best day look like? Because let me tell you, that helps you understand what you're living for. That helps you understand what you're living for. Here's what Paul said. The God who said, let there be light. Boom! And the whole universe was illuminated. He is the same God who has shown us his light in our hearts. And Paul's best day is helping other people see this God, understand how they can have a relationship with Him. Paul's best day is when he can serve and love and speak words of hope and inspiration and truth into the people around him. And I would suggest that if we would begin to make this kind of exchange, there would be things that would happen in our life that would blow our mind. And we would wonder, why did I ever make it about me? At this time, we want to pause and recognize the greatest exchange ever. And we're going to do that through receiving communion. So I'm going to ask the servers to make their way out. And I'm going to ask us to remain in an attitude of prayer, because here's what I want you to think about. As the servers are preparing communion, I want you to ask yourself the question. When I think about the glory of Jesus Christ and what he's done on my behalf, would my day-to-day experience reflect the gratitude and the magnitude of what he's done for me? God's got a plan for you. That's why he brought Jesus to you. Is that plan being experienced as we take our time to focus on him and what he did for us?